I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and our guest today is Roger Bennett from the Men in Blazers podcast and TV show, and the author of the New York Times number one bestseller, Reborn in the USA, An Englishman's Love Letter to His Chosen Home. Today on the show, we explore what it means to be American if you're not born in the United States, the ways the dreams of our youth change as we get older, and of course, we talk a little soccer. The Stacks Book Club pick for August is Emergency Contact by Mary H.K. Choi. We'll be discussing the book on the show on Wednesday, August 25th with Juliet Littman. If you love The Stacks and want to support the show, please consider joining The Stacks Pack on Patreon. You earn perks like our monthly virtual book club and shoutouts on the show. But more important than that, there is no show without the generosity of The Stacks Pack. So if you like what you hear, please head to patreon.com/thestacks and join this awesome bookish community. Thank you to our newest members of The Stacks Pack: Amanda Cervantes, Shannon, Christina, and Alex Henson. I really, really cannot thank you all enough. All right, now let's get to my conversation with Raj Bennett. All right, everybody, I'm so excited. I'm here with Roger Bennett, author of Reborn in the USA. I have to ask, can I call you Raj or do I have to call you Roger?
Tracy Thomas, you can call me whatever you like. It's a joy to be with you. I'm genuinely giddy and excited.
I'm excited to have you. I know on your podcast, Men in Blazers, they call you Raj. So I feel like I know you as Raj. And so writing emails about you to your team and saying Roger a lot, I was like, do these people know that he goes by Raj in my heart?
Only my mother calls me Roger, and only when I'm in trouble. When someone uses the full name Roger, it's an awful name. Just a genuine, I write about this in the book. It's just a horrible, I feel no emotional connection to it. It's like my parents' desperate desire for us to feel deeply English. They gave us, like, my brother's actually called Nigel, which is possibly even worse. If there is one name worse than Roger, it's Nigel. But it's like, it's like calling your kid Harvey or Melvin in America. It's like picking a name that was popular in the 1940s and the 1950s in an effort to fit in. So Tracy Thomas, you can call me whatever you want.
Okay, I'm going to call you Raj. Okay, so this is where we always start. It's sort of, we're going to talk a lot about the book, so don't feel pigeonholed with this one. But in about 30 seconds or so, can you just tell the folks about your book?
I can do nothing in 30 seconds, Tracy Thomas. That's amazing. When I did the book acknowledgements, I said the whole book is essentially an acknowledgement section, so I'm going to keep this short.
And then it went on for
14 pages. So 30 seconds is incredibly tough. I will say, I wrote the book in COVID, lockdown in Manhattan, the city that I'd had painted on my bedroom wall, dreamt of moving to as a kid. And while the city was turned inside out into chaos and human darkness, that led to the Black Lives Matter summer, the trauma and agony of that, and then obviously into the toxicity of the 2020 elections. And the American idea has always been the center of my life. I've organized everything around it. And in the present chaos, I returned into the past to a lot of joy in the past. But I wanted to retrace my love of America and the contours of that love, which is enormous. I always joke that Kenny Powers does not love as America as much as I love America. And I wanted to retrace the footsteps of every ounce of that love and hold it up to the light of day. So it's a love letter to America, Tracy, at a time I think our nation could really do with one.
Yeah, at a time that I think a lot of people are not super in love with our country, for sure. I'm curious about why you chose to tell this part of your story. Because the book is from your youth, sort of up until high school age, and then you come to America for good. So I'm curious why tell the part of the story before you're actually in the States.
There's the American idea. And there's the American reality. Mm. And I wanted to really examine in this book the construction of the American idea. I grew up in Liverpool in the 1980s, a magnificent city, but a city which was just fallen on terribly dark times. The whole north of England under Margaret Thatcher was laid waste to as the south rose at the north's expense and the coal mines shut down and the steel mills and the cotton in Manchester. And Liverpool was the once great port that had no purpose. We had no industry. There was no need for a port. Unemployment soared. Heroin epidemic gripped the city. There was hopelessness everywhere. And, you know, I survived. If you've seen Billy Elliot, you kind of get the picture. He was a great ballet dancer, me not so much. And I survived by telling myself I was an American trapped in a English boy's body. And I just feasted upon every piece of American culture, the movies, books, television shows, the music, every kind of music, Chicago Bears, Super Bowl winning team. And it gave me a sense of courage and hope and joy, and that life could be lived in glorious technicolor, whereas mine felt like it was lived in black and white. And I wanted to examine that, Tracy, that construction of an idea, a perception of America lived without ever setting foot in the land. And that is really the main narrative of the book.
And now that you've been here for longer than you were in Liverpool, and you became a citizen in 2018, I believe you say in the book, I'm wondering how it holds up. Like, how do you navigate falling in love with a place as a young person who, I'm assuming, you weren't super plugged into the politics of Reagan's America and the ways that so much of what you didn't like about Liverpool were happening to so many Americans at the time? I'm from Oakland, which we talked about before we started, which was going through so much similar, you know, we were the crime capital of the country and this and that. So I'm wondering now, like, as an adult, as you reflect back on it, how does it hold up? Does it hold up anywhere? Like, what, or does it hold up everywhere? What are your feelings?
I'd say that it's a twofold answer. Mm-hmm. And the first is, you know, I came to America for the first time when I was 15 to the northern suburbs of Chicago. It's a lot of what the book's about, a trip that changed my life. Right. You know, it was very much like, I mean, God, the northern suburbs was the canvas that John Hughes used to paint his movies. I'd never been there before, but when I landed, it felt like I had been there. I felt like I knew it. You know, even the water tower from his movies was just there in front of me. Glencoe, Northbrook, Highland Park. All I can say is, and I write about this in depth in the book, you know, I met the Chicago Bears, I hung out in the bleachers. I mean, it was all life, Art Institute Chicago, it was all life-changing. And when Ferris Bueller's Day Off came out, it felt like a serious documentary of my time there as opposed to a light rom-com comedy. I was like, that's what I did. I did all of that. And I was like, yeah, I did that too. So, like, America, you know, was remarkable. It was there that I met the Chicago Bears, and one of them, William Refrigerator Perry, in my mind, told me to move to America. I'm sure he had no such intention, but that set me on my course. And I did come back as soon as I could, right after college, and moved to Chicago, which is a place that my family have always meant to move to when they left Eastern Europe, but got off the boat at the wrong stop in Family Myth and ended up in Liverpool because my great grandfather saw the one tall building on the Liverpool skyline, thought he was in New York, and we never made it to Chicago where we was headed. I did make it. And the reality is, I mean, why I wrote the book was that the reality was incredibly dark and challenged. And the twofold answer is, when you have become a new American, when you have stood in a courtroom with 162 other Americans, and I write this in the book, with 42 different countries, and you share stories with them after saying the oath of allegiance, it's to hear their stories about escaping famine, civil war, conflict, worse, and how the idea of America just animated their lives, gave them hope, gave them courage, gave them a sense of confidence and joy and possibility. Then, and I encourage each of your listeners, anyone can go to a naturalization ceremony. It's a beautiful, incredible, human, wonderful thing. And that to me is the most powerful moment where you feel that sense of optimism, that sense of wonder, that sense of immigrant wonder that is deeply, deeply American. But that is the American idea. And the American reality, as your question suggests, is filled with challenge. Mm-hmm. And so the second part of the answer is, the American idea for me was one that was born in my youth. I wrote a whole bloody book about it in great detail, right. Human wonder and joy. The American reality is a very different thing. Both of them are filled with love for me. But one is a childish love, which is simple and just pure and blind. And then an adult love. And anyone who is in love listening to your podcast will know this. Adult love is hard, bloody work. Mm-hmm. It is hard, bloody work. And the object of whatever you love, whoever, and I've not met them, but I can guarantee this, they are not perfect. They have strengths and they have weaknesses. And I feel that love so bloody deeply, absolutely and completely, but it's an adult love now. And so with every ounce of my energy, you know, the epigraphs of books are such weird things. You use somebody else's words to introduce your own, and they're normally much better than anything that follows. And in my case, they definitely are, because it was deeply humbling to use the words of the great American poet Langston Hughes when he wrote, "Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be." Mm. And I offered the book up in that spirit, Tracy, in the, you know, there's the American idea, there's the American reality. And I hope the book is written in the spirit of somebody who wants to close the gap and work with every ounce of his energy to close the gap between the two.
Yeah, I love that. I think that the epigraph is so brilliant, and I've heard you on other interviews talk about it. So I know that it was really like sort of your guide. It seems like it was sort of your guidepost in writing the book, and sort of like your guiding light that you come back to. And I think that is not everyone's book is that true for.
It's a weird thing though, the epigraph. Yeah. It really is. You are literally using someone else's words to sum up or introduce or kind of catalyze your book, but then they are always, and it is in my case. I mean, just my rest, everything that follows is completely in the shadow of the spirit of those three lines.
Yeah, I'm curious about the memoir writing part of it, because I feel like you are someone who's in the public light very much, though mostly talking about soccer and or football, depending on where you're listening from. I'm cool. I know the slang, you know, I know the lingo. But writing a memoir is sort of a totally different thing than talking about other people on the pitch, right? So I'm wondering, and what I've learned from this podcast is, like, so many folks who write memoirs talk about sort of getting vulnerable and reflecting on themselves and on where, who they were at the time of the write, or the time that the book takes place. So I'm wondering how you sort of reflected on your past mistakes or past, I mean, there's lots of sex in the book, or attempts at sex.
Terrible sex. Terrible,
there's
terrible
a lot of
sex.
Desire for sex. There's a lot of, like, boy, girl desire, awkwardness. And I'm wondering sort of how you reflected on that sort of stuff before you actually put it in the book.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of reflecting. You're overestimating my ability to change topics. Look, the first part of your question says, you know, you talk about soccer. Now you're talking about life. And honestly, soccer and life are the one and the same for me. Mm. My anyone who listens to our podcast or our television show, to me, soccer is life. That's why I watch it. It's not a sport. 22 men or women trying to kick a ball around the field, score a goal. There's smarter people than me to talk about the tactics or the mentality. You know, there's people who have won things who can talk about that. But my tiny niche is Albert Camus, who was a great goalkeeper in his day before he was a writer, is alleged to have said, and I like to believe it's true, he said, everything that I know about humanity, the motivations of human beings, I learned through watching football. Mm. And I believe that deeply, that ultimately the joy of football is for me that there's 22 human beings making human decisions, whether they pass, run or shoot, under conditions of hysterical stress, with the world watching, as we've just seen with England and the Euros. Mm-hmm. And that's what I find fascinating. Football is only about sport in the same way as Animal Farm is about horses and pigs on the surface. Like all of life, desire, dreams, hope, shattered hope, fulfillment, glory, agony, all of that is trapped in there. It's why I love sports, because those are things I think most normal people feel in real life, but I'm dead to inside, and sports allows me to feel those things.
Right.
So to me, sports is life, particularly international sports, where two teams take the field, their nation's history and culture and current politics take the field alongside of them. So to me, it's like one and the same. Football is life. My memoir is life, human emotion. And to give your question, you know, a true, honest answer about the vulnerability, we have guests on my show. We're very honored. You know, it's a real array of human beings. And like Ali, the NBA player, Aaron Rodgers, JJ Watt from the NFL, DeAndre Hopkins, and they all come on. And I'm actually more fascinated for them to talk about life than I am to talk about this. They talk about their sport, their craft, all the bloody time. And so it's just using that same methodology, tell me about life, and applying it to myself. And one of our regular guests is John Green, the writer, who I admire greatly. And the thing I admire about him is his willingness to be utterly vulnerable. And I do think after COVID, after this past 17 months we've had, Tracy Thomas, what choice do I have now? It's the only way forward to be candid, I think, for all of us, is to be really, really bloody vulnerable. There's two pathways for us all as a nation and as humanity. We can either be, we've all suffered.
Right.
Many people have truly, truly, truly suffered. There's been the human agonies in ways that I can't even imagine. But all we can do now is lead, I hope, with our vulnerabilities, just for the good of the future.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned earlier, and you talk about in the what do they call it, epilogue of your book, is that you wrote this during COVID, and that you know were watching this whole summer that's like this racial reckoning moment. And I'm wondering how that, I know that you talk about in the epilogue that your friend Jamie and you get on the phone, sort of the last little bit of the book, and you're sort of like, was it all a lie? And he's like, no, we need dreams, like we need something. Even our children's selves, like our past selves, we need that. But I'm wondering, like, as you're writing this book and reflecting on your youth and your love of America, and you're in the present watching so much, as you mentioned, suffering and disparity and people coming to terms with privilege and all this stuff, did that shape your feelings about America, or did you have any epiphanies or feelings that came up that were new from the last 18 months?
I mean, there's three different parts of the year of writing, and it was the outbreak of COVID, the Black Lives Matter summer, and then into the toxicity of the election. Mm. And so I started writing. I grew up in Liverpool. America was this escape, which is a very common thing I've learned in the release of the book. I've had so many Americans be like, oh my God, you dreamt of moving to America. You know, I grew up in LA and I love the Smiths. And I spent my whole time just wishing I grew up in Salford outside of Manchester. Like that. And I realized, you know, my first response when it happened the first time, I was like, oh my God, you dodged a bullet, man. You really wouldn't have survived a minute in Salford outside of Manchester. But But then I realize it's happened over and over again. Mm-hmm. I think we often romanticize that which we are not. It's like a teen adolescent impulse. When you are young and you are trapped in an identity, in whatever, in class, that's hard to shake, you know, you dream of an alter you. I did. I dreamt of an alterna Rog. He was cool mm-hmm. and funny. And people laughed at his jokes and, you know, he was, you know, socially capable in a way that I was probably not. and lots of people have that impulse, that desire to start again. I just happen to have acted upon mine.
Right.
And so on my bedroom wall, I had painted, it was a terrible painting. There's a photograph of it in the book, the Manhattan skyline. If you look at the photograph, it actually is more accurately a depiction of Warsaw in the 1960s. It does. But, I told myself it was skyscrapers. Yeah, it was Manhattan skyscrapers. And every night I would go to bed and just fix my curtains so the light shone directly onto the Statue of Liberty's face, Lady Liberty's face. And so America was this place that I longed to be in, Manhattan in particular. And God, I actually somehow, I'm still not quite sure, made it there. And then COVID just overtook the streets of Manhattan. And this is hard to remember from the perspective of today. It was, the city was just shuttered. I mean, it was devastating. And in those first 3 months, late March, April, May, no one knew what was going on. There was just a deep fear of chaos and the unknown and a devastation. And to have the city that I've dreamt about be overrun, that's the impulse that led me to write the book. I wanted, that's like in that moment where, you know, I'd get up really bloody early and normally the sun rising over Broadway outside my apartment was so thrilling. It's something I never take for granted. It's like a, you know, the opening of a play, their first scene, the lights go on and the city starts right. to get. And I love that. But to know that the COVID was crackling all around those streets really led me to write the bloody book. And then into the Black Lives Matter summer, where I would, you know, I did turn to my wife and I was like, oh my God, like, what am I doing? What? I'm about to bring out a book about, oh, a love letter to America right. at this time of agony and trauma. And that fear, to be honest, during the election, I mean, I was like, where was this book going to live if the election went a certain mm-hmm. way? Was it only going to be lauded on Newsmax and OANN? And so I felt more than anything a deep fear and a deep trepidation. Bringing out a book in 2021 is such a ridiculous thing to do anyway. I mean, it's like doing a masterpiece on a side of a grain of rice. Like, no one really gives a crap anymore about books.
Well, don't say that.
Apart from you, Tracy Thomas.
I do.
I love you. That's why I adore you in your podcast. But the reality is, like, the world is not, the world wants the cultural mechanisms. A book is a bloody hard thing to put out in the world. It is a bloody hard thing to put out in the world. And I was terrified, genuinely. I had no idea what the reaction would be. I didn't know how it would be received. A nut job coming out with a love letter after everything we've been through in the past 17 months. And I'd say, I think it's a depiction of a fairly nuanced love. I hope it's a depiction of a fairly nuanced love. And the way it's been received by Americans, you know, as a new American, has been truly humbling.
It's not only been received well, it was a number one New York Times, instant New York Times bestseller. So let's not pretend like it was received well. It was received incredibly well, which does not surprise me because I know that you are so beloved by so many people. I had told a few people that I was going to interview you and they were like, Rog? And I was like, yeah. They were like, oh my God, including my brother, who's a big soccer fan. And when I told him I was going to interview you, his first thing he said back to me was, ask him why he wants to be American, because I didn't get it. And then he goes 5 minutes later, I've thought about it. And I also would love to be British. So I totally get it, which speaks to what you were saying before.
What's his name?
Brady.
Oh, Brady. Shout out to Brady. Alterna Rog.
But the other question that I was going to ask is, speaking of you wanting to be American as a kid, do your American kids want to be British at all? Are they like, do they walk around like imitating your accent? Like, do they have any interest, or are they like, no, super not cool because of my dad?
Such a great question, Tracy Thomas. Like, Liverpool is a magnificent city. It is incredible. And, you know, I moved to Chicago at the first opportunity right out of university, and I loved the place. because it's a city of dreamers and hucksters and big talkers, you know, everyone. Mm-hmm. It's a city that has no reason to be there unless you are making it big. Like, you have to dream big dreams to be in the middle of nowhere to build that city. It takes some incredible chutzpah. And Liverpool is the same. Like, even in hard times, it's a city of storytellers and comedians and human beings who dream. We look out to sea and we dream anything's possible, even when there's human darkness that surrounds us. And so Liverpool is an incredible city. When I was a kid, I write this in the book, the city council debated seceding from the rest of England and becoming a republic, the Republic of Liverpool, which is an idea, frankly, I love. And so when we go there, all my family are still there. I'm very, very proudly there. My kids love it. They think it's like Disneyland. They prefer to go there than Disneyland. I mean, it's a crazy place. You just walk down the street, there'll be a naked man just trotting alongside for no reason. So you go to the football and it's just human beings all around, the swearing profusely. It's a child's dream of human wonder. And so it's a fascinating thing for me. My youngest kid, Ozzy, wrote a book report for school where he had to do a little author's bio. And he wrote, "Ozzy Bennett is a British American." Mm. And then there were a couple of other lines. And I was like, I looked at it. I was like, holy crap. You know, Britain is a complicated place. The football team from there, you know, the football team became a very brave face of the nation. But in defeat, you saw the darkness of the nation, the racism of the nation, the misogyny of the nation, the hatred of the nation. You know, a lot of the things I moved that kind of propelled me out of there. So when I read that, Ozzy Bennett is a British American, I turned to my wife. I was like, I don't define like that. And, you know, I'm like effing Kenny Powers, an American American. And what I realized in that heartbeat, and I do actually write this in the end of the book, you know, this is my story. This is my American story. And I said to my kids in the book, the end of the book, they don't read books and I'll never see this, but I said, I hope you write your story on your own, in your own way, in your own style, and better than mine. And so if that's what they want, but I also realized doing this book, ultimately, kids want difference. We all want to be singular.
Right.
And to me, my Americanness, this myth that my family were meant to be in Chicago, that my great grandfather had set out for there, but by mistake had got off the boat in Liverpool instead of New York. And so we've been stranded. I was meant to be in America. That made me feel different. And I think the British Americanness, you know, is what make my kids feel different. And in that moment, Godspeed to them.
Yeah. I also think it's interesting that you define yourself as an American, no hyphen. Because I think many people who are immigrants to this country or people who have come here or even, you know, first or second generation, they do include the hyphen. And so that was always something that really interested me. I don't know if you had thinking behind it or you just felt like that was, you just wanted to go straight up American, no follow up.
Like that. So I'm going to put my next passport. The straight up American, no follow up. That sounds like my debut album when I bring it out. That sounds like something Phil Collins would bloody do.
Just add me to the acknowledgements. I just want to be in your super long acknowledgements.
Oh my God. Tracy Thomas, how are you not in my. I'm almost embarrassed. I know I hadn't met you until today, but almost everybody else is in my.
It's true. I was a little left out, I got to be honest. I wanted to ask about also, this is my last question about you and Americanness, and then we're going to talk about the writing of your book, but that could be a lie and I could ask more things. I never know what I'm going to do. But I do want to know about you being an American in an Englishman's body, because you say it all the time. You talk about it in the book. I've heard you say it on interviews. I would love for you to define for my audience and for me what that means, because there's so many ways that could go.
I'd love to know what these so many ways are. I'm quite fascinated.
Well,
now,
like what it is to me, like what being American means to you when you were not yet American. Because to me, like as an American, being American for me means that I'm from America. And like a lot of the American things I don't particularly feel connected to as a Black woman. So I'm just curious sort of like what the American things that you were holding on to that you felt like were who you were, even though you were born in a different place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be clear. I fully understand what you're saying. Chuck Klosterman, God bless that man, blurred my book and said something far smarter than I ever could. He said what Roger Bennett felt was an illusion, but the book is a reminder that perception is not merely a form of historical reality. Perception is all that we have. So my sense of Americanness in that moment, that self-deception, that trick, you know, that trick when you've been beaten up, when you're in a school, which is, you know, the teachers are just kicking the crap out of you. I mean, it was a Grey Gardens with sadistic teachers who were teaching a curriculum that was formed around the end of the First World War, who would thrash you. They really lived to beat the crap out of us.
Right.
You know, you'd go home having been caned, they called it. You go home bleeding and your mum wouldn't be like, oh my God, what happened to you? She'd just be like, oh, Roger, have you been naughty again? And so life was confusing, deeply complicated. Right. Liverpool was falling apart. I mean, that context is really bloody important. Right. Liverpool was, you know, I felt like I could stand on the street corner and if I stared long enough, I could see the city decomposing before my very eyes. So America was, in my mind, that mind, having watched these shows, you know, you watching Miami Vice, watching Don Johnson wearing colors that hadn't even been invented in England yet, teal. I remember, like, what I was saying to my mum, I was like, what is that color he's wearing? She's like, oh, I don't know, never seen it before, love. And this guy wearing just like periwinkle, wearing pastels. I've talked about in the book how he would go on, you know, the most fearsome shootout of his life and everyone else would be strapping on the Kevlar and the helmets. And he'd be like, no. Why would you wear that when you can wear linen pants pleated with no socks, espadrilles, and have a blazer with your sleeves rolled up? And I watched that. And the Americanness of that, Tracy, was this was a man who had a singular style, was different to all those around him. And was willing to commit to that completely and utterly. And so I took that, watching Miami Vice, again, only on the surface was it about the Knox in Florida. To me, it was communicating purely to me as a 14-year-old confused boy how to be in the world. Mm. The Chicago Bears, you know, the NFL started to be broadcast. English football was a backwater, muddy backwater. Hooligan culture, you go to the game and just see human beings kick the crap out of each other. That's why they went to the game. And the NFL started to be broadcast and it was just like laughter, entertainment. The New Orleans Saints that year were like 14-0. And instead I was like, go and beat the crap out of the Atlanta Falcons fans. That's what you meant. Instead, they put paper bags on their heads, called themselves the New Orleans Saints and just laughed and just made a, you know, turned around and just turned it into a thrilling moment that I've not forgotten. And when the Chicago Bears were a team that had been terrible for decades, terrible, self-sabotaging, awful. And I started to watch them when the NFL was broadcast, obviously thinking I was a Chicago and they were my team. My timing was great because after years of self-sabotage, they finally, you know, Walter Payton, the greatest Bear ever to play, made the most out of his career by turning themselves into a hard-living, smash-mouthed, boasting, backing up those boasts with biblical smitings of every opponent team. And again, what was the Americanness to me, Tracy? It was that taught me watching that the identity they had, losers, perpetual losers, was not, you didn't have to be what you were. You could transform yourself into something entirely different. So each of these things, so Tracy Chapman, each of these things, Run DMC, they each of them just spoke to me, you know, obviously from afar, within my own context. And I took life lessons from each of them, and all of them shaped me in deeply profound ways. So lacing together the collective sum of all those lessons, that to me was what I called Americanness.
I like that. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in store. And now save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
It's not lost on me, and I'm sure it's not lost on you, that you are someone who loves America so much and is deeply, feels deeply connected to so much of this country. And yet your professional career is like, you are Mr. Non-American Sports Guy. And I always laugh whenever I'm watching you. Like, there was an interview you did with JJ Watt that was on TV. I can't remember what it was for, but it was like something. And you guys were both talking about football, and he was talking about how much he loves soccer. And you were talking about, like, you know, as Americans, both of us, this and that. And I turned to my husband and I was like, it's just great because he loves being American. He's such an American, and everyone knows him for like the most British-y thing we can think of. It's like, you could only be more British to the rest of America if you were Prince Harry. Like, it's just, it always makes me laugh so hard.
The half brother.
Yes, exactly. The other. Yeah, Roger. That's why your parents gave you a super British name.
That's it. No, genuinely. I everyone always wants to know, like, what do you think of the royal family? I'm always like, I hate the royal family. Like, Tracy Chapman is the only queen that I recognize.
What about,
like,
Beyonce? You have to love Beyonce if you're deeply American. It's mandatory. You
know, the way you said that made me think I was like, ICE were going to crash into my house and extradite me. What about Beyonce? You're quite right. Put me in my bloody place.
Yeah, don't forget.
But the royal family, I have no interest in any of that crap in every regard. And that is very funny. I could really, I've not thought about that. The only way I could be more bloody British, you're saying, as if I was like, here's the cricket. Yeah. Here's the latest cricket score. The cricket, we're going to do the croquet. To me, I've got to be candid. Another story of my life has been about the growth of the game of football here while I've lived here. I moved here ahead of the 1994 World Cup, which was meant to put the sport just, you know, overnight. It was meant to be just a revolution. And soccer was never like the yo-yo or the pogo stick, an overnight sensation. But the joy of my life has been, or one of the joys of my life has been, just the steady and slow growth of America to become what I now call a normal football nation. So I don't think of it, I've got to be candid, I don't think of like football at all as like, oh, I'm binging over the English thing. I actually think there's a incredible, young, vibrant, deeply knowledgeable, unbelievably. And JJ Watt's a great example of it. You know, tons of NBA stars we have on the show. Josh Richardson, Alex Caruso, Larry Nance. These guys have fallen so bloody fast and hard for the sport in the past 5 years. And I don't think of it as an English an Englishness. I do. We joke on the show that soccer is America's sport of the future, as it has been since 1972. But I've got to say, the future very much is now.
I am a new soccer person, and I am obsessed with soccer now. I love it so much. And I am curious what you think about why it never took off. Because now that I've gotten into it and I like have my team and I, you know, wait for the lineups to come out and all of that stuff, I'm like, how come more Americans aren't obsessed with this? This is like the most incredible sport, like watching the fan bases and the chants, which I've missed out a lot on because of COVID, because people weren't in the stadiums. But like I love sports, but everything about soccer I love. Like, soccer has started to push my love of basketball a little bit to the back burner. Like, I was more interested in the Euro Cup this year than I was in the NBA Finals, though my team was out very early, so it sort of made it easier. But even still, I don't really have a team in the Euro, so it wasn't like I was like, oh, my other team is still in. So I'm curious,
Who is your football team?
Oh, Manchester City. I'm a huge Raheem Sterling fan. That's my guy. I also love Phil Foden, one of our own. And then, of course, Pep Guardiola is... My brother wanted me to ask you, why is Pep Guardiola the greatest soccer coach ever? And he answered it with, he just is. But...
it's incredible. By the way, I interviewed Pep Guardiola.
He's a dream.
He's so intense that at the end of the interview, when he left, and it was amazing, he hates doing interviews. And this is a very intense human being. He's like a mad scientist who's taken, for those who don't know him, he's a bald bloke who has taken just the art of coaching just so many different levels above everybody else. And he hates doing interviews and didn't want to do the interview and looked at his shoe, which was a brilliant thing to do. When I asked the first question, it was his way of saying, I'm going to do the interview, but I'm going to give you no material whatsoever. And so he looked at his shoe, hates doing interviews, hates the English press because all they do is jam him up.
Right.
But obviously I'm not the English press. And then I asked him my second question. I said to him, is it like the NFL where you are Bill Parcells controlling the movement of every single human being at all times on that field? Or is it like incredible free jazz where the players essentially are it's just Coltrane and Mingus just riffing, improving all the way through the 90 minutes? And his head snapped up and he goes, that's a great question. And then he just got so into it and just started shouting at me for 35 minutes.
A dream.
Bit like I've done with you. And I didn't quite understand anything he was saying. It was so fast and it was in a thick Spanish accent and I couldn't quite hear, but I knew it was incredible. And I just kept going with it. And then boom, he was gone. And I was so exhausted, Tracy, after I'd finished with him, I just lay on the floor and went to sleep in the interview room. He's that human being. He burnt me up with his intensity. Gosh. He burnt me bloody up with his intensity. Your question was, why did Americans not give a crap?
Well, like, why didn't it become a big, why hasn't it become like a huge thing?
It is big. It is, Tracy.
You think
our women
it is?
Are world bloody champions.
Well, of course,
they're back-to-back world champions. They're unbelievable. If our men become half as good as them, we are blessed.
But like American club teams are like, they're small communities, it's not the same.
Are you talking about the fan base? Are you talking about the thousands and millions of Tracy Thomases? Listen to yourself. Listen to yourself. You just said to me, I can't believe how much I love it. The way you just said to me, Phil Foden, he's one of our own, in your beautiful Oakland accent. Are you a Golden State Warriors fan?
I am.
Steve Kerr adores the football, loves the football, adores Liverpool Football Club. He's regular on our show. There is a young audience.
Yeah.
So the question more is, what has happened to change that? Because when I came to America, it was shocking that football was not just not present. It was actively hated. You know, I remember 1990 World Cup. I was a creepy English counsellor on a summer camp in Maine, and England were in the World Cup semi-final. So I got a day off, and it was the most frustrating day off. I actually just saw in LA the guy I did it with for the first time in 25 years. And we drove around. He was a South African, a wonderful man. And we desperately tried to find the semi-final of the World Cup, you know, the biggest game in the world. And we went from rural Maine sports bar to rural Maine sports bar. And none of them, they all refused to put it on because they're all playing the minor league Portland. I think they're now called the Sea Dogs. I don't know what they were back in the day. But they were just, they took great delight in telling us to sod off. And it was agonizing. And England lost on penalties, as they always do. And I didn't find out until the Boston Globe published the result in tiny font at the back of their sports page the next day. And that was where America was. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, instead of it being an overnight sensation, it's been slow and steady. There's been many factors that have driven its rise. The rise of the internet, which means that you can connect from Los Angeles to your club, Manchester City, mm-hmm. as close as a Mancunian who goes to every home game and lives within 5 minutes of the stadium. You can follow the injuries. You can follow the transfers. You can follow the intrigue. When I got here, we didn't have that.
Right.
And so there was a gulf of information. It's the perfect sport. Like the NFL was perfect for the golden age of television with its 57 camera angles and its breaks for commercials. Baseball, the golden age of radio. Football, global football is the great sport for the internet. EA Sports FIFA, the rise of that, which sensitized a generation of college kids, probably your brother amongst them, to know the players, know that it's different to control Messi and Ronaldo. You get a sense of their different styles, know the teams, that Star Wars cantina worth of like, what's this, the Italian league? What's the Spanish league? You get to
right.
understand all of that. And then mostly just how much is on television now. When I got here, there was nothing.
Right.
Now, every bloody league is broadcast live. And, you know, I always joke that part of it is, God, if you are in a bar at 7:30 in the morning and you are drinking a beer and a scotch, you know, society frowns on that behavior. But if you're in that same bar drinking that same beer and scotch combo and Chelsea are playing Manchester City on the television, you are a football fan.
Yes.
And you should never underestimate the attraction Americans have. And it's fantastic for having excuses to raise a glass together.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be a soccer fan. It's like my new favorite joy in life. I love it so much. We played yesterday, which is very exciting, which means we're coming back.
You pick, by the way, Raheem Sterling, just to pick on the English sum up, is one of the greatest human beings. And I love that you love him. His story is just that he's still so bloody young. He's been around forever. But a lightning rod of just because, you know, it's ultimately the joy of football is that it just holds a mirror to the society
right.
that surrounds it, for good or for bad. And watching Raheem Sterling and the England national team
yeah.
this summer take a nation that is deeply divided and lecture it about racism, about sexual identity and gender, about mental health and depression, the young, confident, diverse, just, I mean, emotionally articulate.
Right.
I mean, the manager, one of the Guardian journalists wrote, Gareth Southgate, the manager, acts as if he is, quote, the last sane adult left in Britain, mm-hmm. which is bloody true. If he was prime minister, England would be Scandinavia. And they made a nation believe, and the nation got behind them. And then in the final, there happened to be three black kids. Really, they were kids who missed the penalties. And then you saw the darkness
right.
of the nation revealed. The true darkness of the nation. And I will just say, Raheem Sterling, the other players, Marcus Rashford, an incredible poet warrior, Sancho and Saka. I hope, because there's a battle going on in Britain right now for what the future of the country will look like. Will it look like the hate and the misogyny and the racism that ended up being the loudest voice in defeat? Because
right.
they only cheer these players when they're winning.
Right.
When they lose, the true nature of that side of Britain comes out.
Right.
Or will it be the side of Britain that the team represented? And Raheem Sterling, you've picked like a true king.
He's my guy. We in our family, my brother was the first soccer fan, and then he converted all of us. And so we all root for Manchester City because that's his team. But my listeners know this, but we all have nicknames for who we are. So I have twins, and so we call them Ezra De Bruyne, and then my son's Quinton, so we call him Quinchenko. And because they're identical twins, and, you know, Kevin and Zinchenko sort of look alike from a distance on the screen.
Yes. How old are your kids?
They're 19 months.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Can I just say, I mean, I hope and I love your story. to me, football is not about the winning, but it's a sense of meaning, the sense of memory, the sense of collective memory, and the sense of, and the sense of connection that it offers people. And just to hear you talk about your brother, to hear you talk about your kids, to hear you talk about your family sharing that together. I hope football continues to provide that for you and yours for years to come.
I hope so, because my brother has purchased my kids' jerseys until they're at least five with their names on them. So they're going to have to fall in love with the sport. But what you were talking about before about Raheem Sterling and the other black players, Saka, Rashford and Sancho, and what we saw in England, which is mirroring what we're seeing this week in America with Simone Biles dropping out and sort of this vitriol against black athletes. And I know that in the English Premier League, they've really been trying to sort of be the face of this Black Lives Matter movement and really trying hard to embrace that. But it's interesting because there aren't any black managers in the English Premier League, at least not on the top flight teams.
Or owners, or really any board. There's one or two, but very few board members. I mean, it's...
Yeah. So like, what gives? Like, do you see that happening? Do you see that there will be some sort of leadership that will embrace that too? Or do you think not so likely?
You know, watching the fallout to the Simone Biles thing is just
horrible.
Utterly horrible. Humanly devastating. So we're talking at an awfully low moment in just the culture wars that are just eviscerating much of the joy of sport. And all the God, I mean, just the Piers Morganification of of punditry and outrage and just general crap. So you're catching that with having this conversation at a low moment for all of us. Look, I mean, I think that's the challenge for the Premier League, which has had a tradition post Black Lives Matter of taking the knee before the game. And there's a sense of, when you talk to some of the players, they're like, hang on a minute, we've been doing this now for 14 months. And like, are we just doing this? It's like a theatre, or is there actually profound change that's going on? As you say, the number of managers is very, 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 Patrick Vieira, Crystal Palace, there's very, very, very few. I mean, it's more at the ownership level, the board level, where money is made in, just like here, you know, Michael Jordan in the NBA, but there's not, you know, in the boardrooms, in the exec suites, that's where the real change needs to happen. And I cannot answer the question of, will it happen?
Sure.
All I can say is it's not close to happening. It hasn't occurred. And one of the devastating stories of the summer was that all of this happened in an era of fanless sports. They took the knee. It was deeply meaningful. When you talk to the players and you hear them articulate what they felt in that moment, was human poetry. But the England national team was preparing to go for the Euros, and fans were allowed back in the stadium for the practice games before the Euros for the first time. For the first time in like 15, 16 months, diehard football fans returned to the stadium. And the first bloody thing they did when they got back into the stadium, England fans, to watch the England national team, was boo the players, their own bloody players. Right. They booed them when they took the knee. And it was... I was like, that's what you were racing back. That's what you miss most. That's what you wanted to do. The first thing that you came back into the stadium is boo these guys, these gentlemen who are representing you. And it was devastating. And it was worse because it went on for 10 days. Instead of, you know, Gareth Southgate, this manager I'm telling you about, instead of, he's like the Phoenix Suns manager. He's like Monty Williams, he's got deep emotional intelligence.
He's great. I love him. He had a great answer about if they were to have won, if it would erase his loss when he was a player. And he was like, no, because I'm teammates to people and I let those people down as well.
Gareth Southgate, like Monty Williams, has just deep emotional IQ, deep emotional intelligence. And he had to spend the 10 days going into the tournament. That man should have been talking about lineups, his first choices, the depth chart. That's what managers are meant to do.
Right.
And instead, he very patiently, for 10 days, for hours at a time, had to give the entire press corps and the nation a lesson in identity, racism, And the power of taking the knee, and it was devastating to watch, to be candid. So having gone through that summer and having gone through the outcome, Tracy, that I've just talked about, if I was a betting man, I'd say the answer is probably not. It's going to take a long time. Bloody work in every way,
which is really sad. I told you I would ask you about your book a little bit more, like the process, and it's something that I do with everyone. So we have to get you on record with some of these questions.
Let's
They're the most important questions to me personally. So we have to do them, which is, and this is part the first most important question, which is, how do you write? Where are you? How many hours a day? Do you have snacks and beverages? Do you listen to music? Do you have your Tracy Chapman going? What are your rituals? Like, kind of set the scene for how you wrote this book.
So I wrote this book in a fever dream.
Okay.
COVID. I'd refer back to my earlier answer. So COVID shut down the city. I was deprived of sports.
Right.
Sports shut down. I need to do things. Like, I do believe life is a gift and I want to make the most of every moment. So I love work. I love working. I love working with my team. And then sports shut down. And I'm fascinated by the Churchill War Rooms as a kid in London.
I've been there.
You have? Mm-hmm. Amazing. Yeah. So, you know, describe what it is. You don't need me
to. Underground. It's where Churchill was, like, doing all his brainstorming and working and plotting during the Blitzkrieg, I think.
The Battle of Britain, when the Germans were bombing the crap out of London.
And he was underground, and there was all these, like, little rooms. It was almost like sort of, like, it's like an underground compound, and there was like a room for the secretaries to be doing the Morse code.
Deep underground. When London was being blown to crap,
exactly.
And the whole of Europe had fallen. Like Churchill, I've got to be candid, deeply complicated human being. So this is less about him, but more about those war rooms. Like, in times of human darkness, I do believe, like, the true nature of human beings is revealed. And when COVID occurred, I did what with my team. I wanted to step up, provide more meaning, provide more content, provide more joy, more connection. And so I threw myself into a variety of many projects, most of them insane. One of them was writing this book, and I would write it every afternoon for 4.5 months. I'd just sit at my laptop, having got through my, you know, I did a podcast a day, Churchill War Room style. I did a newsletter every morning, Churchill War Room style. And then in the afternoon, I'd feverishly write this book madly. I went through about 5 laptops because I was really like in a movie, like typing like a mad person in a movie. And I didn't go outside there's a photo that I posted of myself on my Instagram the day the book went to number one. And it was me stumbling out to see my wife. My wife took it for the first time I'd been outside in 4.5 months. And like, I look horrific. I've looked like Hanks era in that, what was that movie where he's on the island with the beard and volleyball?
Castaway.
So it was like Castaway, Rog. I had the beard. The most horrific part is like my arms are so white. They almost look translucent. Like, I look ill. And so that's how I wrote, like a madman. And I wrote because I had to. And you asked me about vulnerability. I didn't even think, what do I want to put in? What do I don't? What don't I want? I just went for it. And that was it. When I look back on the book, I don't know how the hell I did it, to be honest. Wow. I don't know. It wasn't a writer like, yes, I like to rise early, light a joss stick, incense, and meditate for 30 minutes. Then I read poetry for 20 minutes, and then I write always 12 pages, good or bad. It was none of that. It was just like, right, because my God, I don't know what is going to happen. I've got to get this story out of me.
Okay, you missed the important part of the question, though. Snacks or beverages, did you have any?
I drink a lot of coffee.
Okay.
A lot. I'm pretty all in on the coffee.
Okay.
And then, God, on the snacks, I'm like, so, I mean, I'm 87% cashew products. And then the music, I listen to music all the bloody time. So, I mean, the funny thing, I listen to a lot of Australian indie radio first thing in the morning. I listen to an amazing show on the radio station, Triple J, Home and Hosed, which plays every new Australian indie band that have released. And I'd talk about it. I'd published my favorite bands in the newsletter. I get all these Australian band managers being like, hey, do you know my band? And I'd be like, what do you mean? And they'd be like, no, like, they've only had 12 listens in Australia and you're writing about them as if they're the Beatles. So I love my Australian indie music, but I did make a playlist of all the tracks, and it's actually in the book, that I listened to in the 1980s because music was very actionable as a, like I could order cassettes from America. And so getting all that music together on one playlist in which Tracy Chapman really features deep very, very, very heavily, that would get me through the rest of the day.
I love it. Okay, my other very important question is, what is a word you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Oh my God, there's so bloody many. That's hilarious. There's so many words that I'm just not comfortable with at all, which is hilarious.
Same.
Oh my God. What word can I never get right on the first try? Cincinnati is the most humiliating of all. Yeah, but it's not okay. It's really not, at this stage, it's not okay. And it's not willful. It's just that I do actively try and get it right in every regard. But Cincinnati, no matter how conscious I am, it like stumps me every time and it pulls me. And I want to say big shout out to Skyline Chili, which is why I prefer to talk about the land of Skyline Chili, which I can spell, although sometimes I spell chili wrong.
I do too as well. I'm a terrible. If there's too many consonants, it fucks me up. Okay, last two questions for you. One is for people who love your book, Reborn in the USA. Are there any books you might recommend to them that are in conversation or that you just feel like kind of have a similar vibe or that you just think they should read because you love them?
Yeah, I mean, God, that last one is a long bloody answer. Okay. I can say, you know, I had three... I have three books around me while I wrote the whole bloody time. And one is Fargo Rock City, Chuck Klosterman's book, which is to me like that. I remember reading that for the first time and I don't know anything about the music. And it did, I was not deeply moved by Ace Frehley in any way, shape or form. But the way he wrote it took you into that time and that place and made it live for you in a way that you didn't have to listen to the music or really know what he was talking about. He brought you there. And I thought that was very powerful. There's the collective works of Audre Lorde, which I genuinely love. And whenever I did get stuck, I mean, a lot of poetry, to be candid, I find really is so useful when you are exhausted, knackered, and can't really spell Cincinnati properly. It refocuses you. And her willingness to just really try and speak so powerfully to so many issues, so many complicated issues, so way ahead of her time, so many complicated intersecting identity issues, and just speaking so succinctly and powerfully at the simply and powerfully at the same time. Thing like that was what I kept trying to work on being. I mean, I wouldn't compare my work is at the bottom of the mountain. Audre Lorde is not even top of the mountain. She's like in the ether above the mountain. But to be simple and powerful in your writing, to say things simply is something that I really try to work on. Then the other one is above my head at all times. I always try and have him on television, which is the complete works of Primo Levi, who is my favorite author of all time. And his essays, just his willingness to articulate with true horror and true trauma, the truth of humanity. I actually called my fourth kid, named him after Primo Levi. And it's like that was my wife's way of telling me that we were done. She finally let me do that. But God love.
Those are great authors to include. Okay, last one. One person, dead or alive, to read this book. Who would you want it to be?
Oh, that's easy. Tracy Chapman.
Yeah.
In every regard, there's not many questions that for me Tracy Chapman is not
the answer.
Not the answer to. She is, and I'm so happy that Tracy Chapman is now like back in vogue and in the ether and just truly respected for what she is, which is, I mean, she's just a true poet, singular herself in every way, vulnerable, authentic. And that I've always talked about it on the show. And when I started to talk about it, it was like in a time where I'd say it and people would laugh. Mm. But they laughed when I loved her the first time. I loved her. It's a big scene in the book. Yeah. One of my teachers, my mentor, my only great teacher in a horrible school, he gave me her album. before it became popular, and it was one of the few albums that I just fell in love with first listen. And I used to play it for everybody that would listen, and people laughed at it the first time I played it for them. So I couldn't give a crap about the laughing. And the reality, her story, which is ultimately deeply intertwined with mine, sadly from a distance, for me, because I think she's just an incredible human being. The climax of the book, with Liverpool turning into a pool of darkness, was her becoming famous, which she did overnight at the Nelson Mandela concert when Stevie Wonder was meant to headline, but his synthesizer blew up and the organizers threw on this unknown who played earlier in the day as filler because she could play an acoustic guitar. She didn't need electronics to perform. So in prime time, this unknown human being was flung back on stage in front of 72,000 drunk English people at Wembley Stadium. And I was like, oh my God, what are they doing to her? I knew what my fellow English people were capable of. They were going to tear her apart. They wanted to hear "I Just Called to Say I Love You." And she looks terrified. You can see this on YouTube, and I'd encourage you to. It's amazing. She stumbles on. She looks terrified, but she fires up the opening bars of Fast Car, and she draws mystical strength from her own wisdom. And line after line, she becomes more and more powerful. And she does just a second, and you can see where the Wembley turns from it. They were chanting for Stevie Wonder all the way through the opening of her song, and then it just stops, and suddenly she's got the audience in her hand, and she's turned Wembley, as vast open Wembley, into the most intimate setting. And she did it by speaking her honest joy, you know, about her pain, about her agony. And her message was, don't be passive. If life is dark and challenging, you are not alone. Be prepared to make bold changes and get out while you can. And it's because of her, you know, singing that I am here. And so, long answer to your short question, but my Lord, I mean, Tracy, she's the one, the guest I want to have on the show is Primo Levi, who sadly cannot come on our show. But Tracy Chapman is just the one interview that I would, if I could interview Tracy Chapman, that would be
it. Would you retire after?
Yeah. America would be better off. And then if I do retire, football. I do think of myself as the last thing holding football back from going over the top,
right,
in America.
Right, because you have the Raj curse.
Yeah, so that was once I'm done, football will just generally explode.
Oh my gosh, no, we need amazing. You. I need you to explain everything to me. I'm always like, I don't get it. And then I'm like, let me go listen to what they have to say on Men in Blazers because I need help.
Tracy Thomas, you need no help. Your podcast is remarkable. You are amazing. Your story of your brother, your own love affair with the game that's nascent, the twins, is one that really is, it's all that's good about sports and life. So it's a joy to be with you.
Well, thank you. This was so great. Everyone at home, go get Reborn in the USA by Roger Bennett, not to be confused with his alter ego, Raj, his chill alter ego, but the real Roger, his mother's child. The book is out in the world. It's funny. It's got some emotion going on. It, as we talked about, lots of pop culture references, and not so much soccer, believe it or not. So you can get to know the man behind the soccer. Raj, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, Tracy Thomas, it's a total delight. Thank you for having me. Courage.
Thank you. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you all for listening, and thank you to Raj for being my guest. I'd also like to thank Maureen Cole and Miranda Davis for making this interview possible. Our August book club pick is Emergency Contact by Mary H.K. Choi, which we will discuss on the show on Wednesday, August 25th with Juliette Littman. If you like what you hear, please consider supporting the show by going to patreon.com/thestacks. Please make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. For more from the show, follow us on social media, at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Sebastian Alcala is our sound editor and producer. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirages. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.